This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Radio EcoShock has remarkable guests. Our next is no exception. He was a lawyer advising China to bring big-name multinational companies into that Asian economy. Now he's writing about anti-globalization, localizing economies, and the coming collapse of the Western banking model. His latest book is Fusion Economics, How Pragmatism is Changing the World. Who is Lawrence J. Brom? Let's find out. Lawrence Brom, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
It's hard to understand your activism, Lawrence, without a quick run-through of where you came from. Tell us about your work in China in the 1990s.
Well, my work in China was actually on the other side of the table. I was first a lawyer and economist advising multinational corporations on their entry in China, because that's what I thought was, you know, a way to transform China from planning to market. But later, working actually as an advisor to the government on that transition and realizing very clearly that the approach would not be shock therapy, IMF, World Bank. These cookie-cutter models were not working for China. So I was very actively a participant in the advisory group of then-Premier Zhu Rongji on state-owned enterprise reform and financial reform. But later, after he stepped down, I decided to go down to the grassroots and set up social enterprises, really at the community level, in the old section of Beijing, and then onwards into Tibet, where we built a very expansive social enterprise built on the principles of heritage restoration, community empowerment, as well as reaching out to communities, nomadic communities, with medical care and education.
You would be making big money. Why did you leave the legal world?
I'd had enough, and I had also an ethical problem with what I saw as the imposition of systems that don't work or that in many ways ultimately lead to the disenfranchisement of people. And so what I really felt was needed was not just top-down approaches and approaches of globalization, but rather diversified localization. Also, I realize that you can't think of economics simply as a material growth measurement or matrix. You have to think of it as involving psychology of people, and that has to do with community, it has to do with spirituality, it has to do with topography, geography, all the things that affect people and make people human. And just accumulating or consuming conspicuously, as the classical economists advise, is not a formula for a healthy economy. At some point, you just have to face yourself in the mirror and say, ethically, what can I stand for and what can I live with?
And you founded something called the Himalayan Consensus. Please tell us what that is.
Well, the Himalayan Consensus evolved naturally from my work with social enterprise in Tibet. We realized that the approach of the grassroots, the approach of community empowerment, really was something that was working. And we wanted to see what else was out there, who was doing what in the region. And to my surprise, traveling all across South Asia, I found out a lot of people, a lot of groups are all engaging in different ways to empower their community, get off the grid, come up with decentralized renewable energy, microfinancing solutions for community empowerment. And I realized not only are we not the only ones out there, but if you connect the dots between all of these, what they call alternative economic models, we have a new mainstream. And bringing on board people like Mohamed Yunus, who were pioneering then microfinance, or the Bhutanese government that was calling for gross national happiness rather than gross national product as a measure of economic health. We really fused these ideas together. The Himalayan Consensus emerged as three core principles: protecting ethnic identity or local identity, includes everything involving heritage, culture, community, through the second principle, which is a business, which then calls for changes in the nature of our global finance, because capital is not getting to people. It's being taken away from people. It's going to capital markets and in many ways disenfranchising communities. So to reverse that process. And the third pillar is the protection of the environment and making that not only a priority of all business decisions, but actually seeing that as an opportunity for the next mega growth trend in business, that is the technology and innovation required to create renewable and efficient energy systems, water and catchment recycling systems to protect our planet and make it available for future generations.
And Lawrence, you've written about the move away from the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency. If I'm just a simple American working in California or Iowa, what does it matter to me whether the dollar is the reserve currency or not?
Well, it comes down to the simple question that if the dollar is the reserve currency of the world, as was set up in the Bretton Woods system after World War II, the Fed can print as many dollars as it wants without ever having to worry about devaluation or any of the effects of that would happen in any other country. And so simply, for instance, the quantitative easing, which has then allowed the federal government to print trillions of dollars on the basis of buying back its own debt, has created a financial bubble or incubating the next major financial crisis. So if another country is China or a collection of countries, for instance, the BRICS through the BRICS Development Bank, issue a second reserve currency that is broadly accepted, particularly in the developing world, or those parts of the world which are being pushed off of the grid consistently, like Russia, you will then see a challenge to dollar supremacy with another option for a reserve currency. That would unfortunately allow other countries to print as much money as they want, but it would limit the power of the US dollar and its influence. And that, of course, it affects somebody in California because it affects their expectations. It affects the power of the federal government. It affects the power of it to simply print money and come up with this type of inflated artificial financial policy that has fueled our capital markets and is continuing to make the 1% richer and disempower more people in the country.
So in 1996, you wrote a book predicting China would become number one, the world's largest economy. Some people at that time thought it was a bit nutty. Has it happened?
Well, in 1996, I wrote a book called China is Number One, playing with the name that Ezra Vogel, who once wrote Japan is Number One, had predicted the rise of Japan. And really, I wasn't panda-hugging. I wasn't praising China. I was just on the inside working with the policymakers on a daily basis. I knew the trajectory of what they were doing and where it would go. And I said, look at these facts. This is where this economy is headed, and it will become one day the number one economy in the world. And according this past year to statements of the IMF, it is. And as the number one economy, China has now a whole different position. So people who were then bashing me, saying I was a panda hugger at the time, can look that China's number one was a prophecy. I mean, it's basically looking at the tea leaves, but seeing clearly what will happen based on facts of the time. Hmm. I'll add that I have similarly predicted the rise of a second reserve currency. In 2009, I was speaking at the Center for Strategic International Studies in Washington, and there were actually people there who did not want to allow me to take the stage and speak because of comments I had written in their newsletter about China and India wanting to get out of the IMF, or not out of the IMF, to create their own alternative to the IMF and World Bank, because they were not able to get enough influence in these institutions despite their financial might and economic growth. And because of their frustration in not having that influence, they would set up an alternative financial system with an alternative to the IMF and World Bank, which we now see with the BRICS Development Bank and the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. And moreover, that the end game of this would be a new reserve currency. And at that time, people were really, really angry with me. But we've already now seen the emergence of these new financial institutions, a South-South financial architecture being put into place as an alternative to the Bretton Woods institutions. And I sincerely believe that the next reserve currency is just around the corner.
China's supergrowth has come at tremendous cost, though, Lawrence. You told the BBC that about 70% of the underground water in China is undrinkable, and about 60% of all surface water is too toxic for human contact, and we can't live without water. Can China restore its balance with nature?
This has been the focus of my work the past 2 years. I have been an advisor to China's Ministry of Environmental Protection, and I've actually argued quite vociferously against what I call the blind growth model. And we need to look at why that model exists. All your Bloomberg, CNBC, everybody is guessing, is China's growth 8%, 7.5%, 7%, what will it be? And we have to understand that the original 8% growth target was set in 1998 by Zhu Rongji to deal with a very specific issue at that time, and that was the transition of overemployed labor from the state-owned enterprises into the private sector as they reformed those enterprises into corporations. And that number, 8%, given the circumstances at the time, was fixed as a formula. However, following Zhu Rongji's retirement, the following premier, Wen Jiabao, focused on high growth, and everything was about surpassing 8%. This was done really through a $3 trillion stimulus package on fixed asset investment. Officials were being promoted on the basis of growth, which really meant redundant projects. And this fueled a lot of hypergrowth in China. Inflation made actually the labor force compatible with other parts of the world, driving manufacturing out of China, and in turn polluting the river systems, the agricultural systems, depleting the forest, and opening a plethora of mining licenses. And I've been very openly critical about this and calling for a rethink of the GDP model, which I do believe that rethink is taking place right now. There are signs of that. For instance, Zhejiang province announced about 2 months ago that they would have local officials promoted only on the basis of clean air and healthcare systems, not on the basis of GDP. And the leadership is starting to mince their words with statements like elasticity of growth rather than fixing to growth numbers. And so I think that this is a sign of a change of thinking at the top. China is facing an impending water crisis. It is also facing a potential food crisis. They have polluted most of their agricultural systems. This is one reason why they're investing very heavily in Africa and Patagonia and South America to be able to acquire food security. But they also realize they need to change their own environmental damage. Another aspect of the advice that my team has been giving is that if they're going to continue with fixed asset investment growth, fine. But that fixed asset investment growth needs to be in regridding the system, getting away from fossil fuels, particularly coal, which accounts for 70% of all energy needs. And signs of this shift are taking place. They've already announced that they will be putting in 20 million electric car filling stations, meaning electricity filling stations, by the year 2020. And using fiscal and credit policies, they're giving $9,000 rebates to people if they buy electric cars. This is a sign of this shift taking place. But there's a heck of a lot of work that's going to have to be done.
As there is in all countries. Now, you are tuned to the Radio EcoShock Show. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Lawrence J. Brom, author of Fusion Economics, How Pragmatism is Changing the World. As I heard it, Lawrence, you attended the 2011 climate conference in Durban, South Africa, and left in disgust to join the protesters outside. What did you see there?
Well, what influenced me most was not just the protests, because nobody inside could hear with all the Darth Vader security, you know, separating the protesters from the heads of state and delegates inside. What impressed me was actually a group of African students at KwaZulu University who were coming up with their alternative COP meeting. And that meeting they carefully mapped out the procedures and steps that would be required to create 1 million climate change jobs. Using the number of unemployed, official unemployed in South Africa, 1 million people, they were saying we're going to create 1 million jobs through the process of transitioning fossil fuel energy plants to renewable systems, going from coal-fired to solar, which certainly South Africa has a lot of, wind, other sources. And they had this thing so carefully planned out, step by step. I thought it was an incredible policy brief. And I actually took it back to China. And it was the inspiration from these African students that was behind the climate change work that I did for the next 2 years of, again, looking at fiscal and credit policy together with fixed asset investments of the state to transition grids from fossil fuels to renewables and to add the energy saving insulation and water recycling systems that are needed to be able to create a sustainable planet, but also to create jobs, employment, and re-empower people. And want to know something? That's what we need to be doing back in the United States. The $3 trillion of quantitative easing have gone into banks, which have just played with the derivatives market. It is basically put on intravenous, you know, the dead animal of the financial market after 2008 resuscitated it and created inflation in Asia as these banks and investors have, institutional investors have speculated on commodities and minerals and growth there. None of it went into our infrastructure, and none of it went into communities. And it should have gone into infrastructure that's renewable and efficient and created real jobs for real people while bringing down energy costs. And that would have been a sensible and rational use of the $3 trillion, which is now actually incubating the next financial crisis just around the corner.
We probably could have gotten the United States off of fossil fuels for $3 trillion.
You not only could have done that, but you would have created real employment. Even with the so-called improved labor figures now, I'm sorry, I'm out in San Francisco. You've got more people begging on the streets there, homeless, than you do in New Delhi. And that's not a joke. I had been in New Delhi only a few weeks before visiting San Francisco, and I was really shocked. And all of that money is trading commodities, also the so-called tech stocks. We have an economy now that's driven by four stocks, Twitter, Google, Facebook, and Apple. Apple's the only one that actually produces anything. And it's really all about a future option in a commodity. It's a soybean. And, you know, nobody ever cooked the soybean at the end of the day in a future commodity trade. And we really need to be putting the capital market money into renovation of technology for the environment, for climate change, and to create real jobs, not just for a few tech kids, but jobs that will be reaching the middle class and blue-collar workers, because all of the regridding that's needed in our system is necessary not only for clean energy, but for cost-efficient energy, and more so to upgrade our infrastructure, which right now is way, way behind Asia.
That's sad to hear. Now, you mentioned China made major investments in Africa, including buying farmland there. You've been in Africa, and you created something there called the African Consensus. Tell us about that, please.
Well, the African Consensus builds on the principles of the Himalayan Consensus about community empowerment through local business and finance, protecting the environment. But it goes beyond that. Because in Africa, civil society has really taken over and is leading the effort at addressing their own community issues. That's partly because of the dysfunctionality of government, not too different from our own system, and the failure of aid programs, which are basically political and impose conditions that may not be relevant for these countries. And so with the African Consensus, we're really trying to build on the principles of the Himalayan Consensus, but the African activists have added a few more principles. For instance, food and water is a human right. Also in the African Consensus Declaration, which was adopted by the African Commission on Human and People's Rights in Gambia in April 2011 at their NGO forum, the view was taken that conflict and even terrorism is not caused by religion, as is popular in many mainstream Western media, but rather it's caused by the disempowerment of people economically and the marginalization of their identity. And with these two issues are addressed, it will severely reduce the amount of conflict and terror.
Now, you've been an international trade and investment lawyer, and you've also, as we've just heard, created a lot of alternatives to centralized power. What is your vision in the book on fusion economics?
Well, the vision of fusion economics is if we take the so-called alternative approaches to economics around the world and we connect the dots, we'll realize that we already have a new mainstream. That mainstream is looking at business differently. It's looking at community empowerment. It's looking at a more holistic way of evolving our planet. It's looking at future generations rather than just aggrandizement or luxury for the current generation. And it is involving solutions that are not coming from think tanks, not coming from ivory tower university professors who have not ever dealt with business or community challenge in their life. It's coming from the communities. It's coming from people who worked out the solutions themselves. And it's really saying, look at these solutions, recognize them as innovation, look at the environmentalists, tree huggers, but as your R&D for the future, and those coming up with the local solutions, whether it's community finance or whether that is social enterprise or whether it's renewable efficient energy systems at the community level, as your innovators, and get capital to them and let them empower themselves. It's looking at not at the monolithic globalization, it's looking at diversified localization. It's rejecting the idea of Thomas Friedman that the world is flat and everybody should be Walmart, and saying, no, the world is quite round, it's quite diverse, it's quite complex, and within that complexity, we should rejoice in its diversity, and we should allow those systems that are diverse by nature to thrive, rather than try to boil them down into one flat melting pot and put everything in a box on a shelf where it's cheap for a multinational corporation to distribute it and basically leave people without identity or without self.
Lawrence Brum, what are you working on these days and who are the people you're talking most with?
Right now, with the organizations, the Himalayan Consensus, the African Consensus, as well as the New Earth Institute, I'm working as an economic advisor, primarily on climate change issues. The key focus right now, for instance, this morning I was working on a draft bilateral agreement between the European Union and China on issues of climate change. That agreement will be discussed and most likely signed in Brussels this summer, can go to Paris. I'm also working advising the Bhutanese government on waste treatment issues, water issues, and we're convening the Himalayan Consensus process this autumn in the September 9th and 10th in Kathmandu, which is really looking to feature those young, innovative, social, enterprise, and environmental economic pioneers in the region and bring business and financial leaders to the table to look at how those breakthroughs of innovation can be scaled. Also inviting government to come and listen. Our view is government steal this idea. And in addition, in the U.S. side, I've joined a group with Transition Towns of America and permaculture leaders there to try and present to Jerry Brown a proposal on California's water crisis. Again, trying to work from the community level and roll out the permaculture solution and scale it, and demonstrate how permaculture run at the community level can save vast amounts of water and increase food production. And for a state with a lot of people who don't have food, that's pretty necessary.
We've been talking with a whirlwind named Lawrence J. Brum, and you can find out more on Lawrence's YouTube channel. His most thought-provoking new book is Fusion Economics, How Pragmatism is Changing the World. Look for that. Find more links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Lawrence, thank you for your tireless work and for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.